Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who has both casual and formal golf shoes, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. And hey, congrats to one of the good guys and one of the most respected men on tour, Mark Leishman, on his win in Malaysia at the CIMB Classic. It's not long ago that his wife was laying in a hospital suffering from an infection that left her with a 5% chance of living. She's rebounded. Their kids are happy and healthy, and his golf game is prospering. Well done, Leish. Good on you. This week, we check in with Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, and also revisit our conversation with HBO Real Sports correspondent Armin Katayan, who, along with Jeff Benedict, has written the most in-depth and insightful book on Tiger Woods to date, in my opinion. But we begin with Ron Green Jr. Ron, you haven't been, quote-unquote, on assignment, I don't think, since the Ryder Cup. And I know even when I'm off the radio, it seems I'm never far from doing things associated with being on the radio. Are you able to get away from the game? I mean, outside of talking to people like me, of course, when you just have a couple of weeks away?
Well, that depends if you can. Getting away from the game, going out there chasing my lame golf game around a golf course. I've been doing some of that and I'm living proof that teaching pros may never go out of business because I am a mess right now. Favorite time of year to play, and I just get out there and just beat it around. But anyway, it's all fun, and I pull away from it a little bit. I mean, with the tour being in Malaysia and Korea and China, all that, I think it feels a little distant right now. Been to a couple football games, was sitting in the stands at Keenan Stadium Saturday night watching the Tar Heels not hold on to that one, and watching the Panthers and all that. But I think if you're around golf and feel like golf is part of you, it's never far away.
When you look back at a year and the work you've done and what still is left or whatnot, is there a story that you have in the back of your head that you've wanted to do for a while, but you hadn't had the chance? So you've sort of put that as, if I get a chance this next year, I want to do this. Is there one of those out there for you?
I think there's several. Yeah. In fact, we were having a telephone conversation, sort of a long-distance staff meeting this week and talking about some of those things. I think there are a lot of things. I mean, you start looking at, U.S. Open will go to Pebble Beach, the 100-year anniversary of Pebble Beach, doing stuff like that. You start flipping through anniversaries. It'll be 20 years next June since Payne Stewart won at Pinehurst. I mean, you think about the time, how fast that's gone, and the legacy of Payne Stewart is still one of the great Sundays ever in U.S. Open history. I mean, there are all sorts of things. I mean, there's a place I want to go do a golf course story on, a place called Goat Hills out there near San Diego that John Ashworth, the famous shirts, kind of got started and built from scratch and is unlike anything else. So, yeah, there are things like that. And then so we shall see where they go. I need to do like tour players do, and they, like Justin Thomas, puts his year-long goals in his phone and doesn't share them. I need to come up with a list of stories and start ticking them off, because I think about a lot of them. Then I'm like, then when you're trying to find one, like, God, I had a good idea the other day. Now I can't remember what it was.
You bring up Payne Stewart. I was thinking about him this morning, and I hadn't thought about that. It's going to be 20 years since the victory at Pinehurst. But I was thinking how the game would be different today if Payne were still around. What were some things that perhaps would have happened? I think for sure he would have been a Ryder Cup captain, and I think maybe would have, he was on his way to fast becoming this, but I think he would have sort of stepped into that Arnold Palmer type role in the game of the go-to person for the way things should and shouldn't be done. And I think we could have avoided, or I hope we could have avoided, some of these Ryder Cup missteps just by Payne being around. Or am I giving him too much credit?
Well, I think he was, he loved the Ryder Cup. And I think one of the last images a lot of us have is him spraying champagne and all that at Brookline and all those sorts of things. What he did at Pinehurst. I think he was a changing person by the time he won at Pinehurst. I mean, the early Payne Stewart, you didn't necessarily want to spend a whole lot of time around. I mean, he was not everybody's favorite guy. He was cocky to the point of almost being arrogant and rude at times, and could be difficult. But he had, you know, he talked a lot about having changed his life and found some religion and other things. And I think that's why his loss was felt sort of dramatically, because, you know, people like Paul Azing and others can talk in more detail, more depth about it. But I think he was growing into the role he could have down the future. I think he would have been a terrific Ryder Cup captain, and I think he could have been what you're talking about. I think he had to smooth over some rough spots from his sort of post-adolescence, I guess. But he was growing into that guy, and sadly, we never got to sort of see it continue.
I think he would have been great on TV, too. Ron Green Jr. from the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. We talked a little bit last time about the current Hall of Fame inductees, and a couple of questions have come about since that I find interesting. Number one, how do we go about judging players from the past whose numbers appear to be on par with some that have been let in recently? And two, how do we reconcile the differences between the LPGA Hall of Fame, which is very stringent, and there's no question if you reach those numbers, you're a Hall of Fame player, and the World Golf Hall of Fame, which seems to be a lot more lax?
Well, I don't know if lax, I think just different criteria. I think the LPGA Hall of Fame is just, I mean, it's obviously not impossible to reach those goals or those achievement levels because players do it, but I mean, when you look at Laura Davies and Jan Stevenson and all they didn't qualify. I mean, that's, you know, that's a pretty strong list of things you got to do to get there.
But the argument would be that truly separates the Hall of the Great from the Hall of the Really Good.
Well, and I think it goes back to the old, age-old argument. I mean, is it purely the Hall of Achievement or the Hall of Fame? I mean, it's the Hall of Fame. That's why Fred Couples is in there, because there have been very few players as popular and as adored as Fred Couples, who could have won more tournaments and won one major championship. Whereas, you know, you look at a guy like Tom Weisskopf, whose career obviously is as good as Freddie Couples was, and is not in there. I mean, I think when they convene in 2 years, I think Weisskopf will be a name that's discussed a great deal there. You know, I don't know. I think, you know, in baseball, sometimes I look at guys and it's like, okay, they have to, they've got to get 4 out of 6 of these things and they automatically qualify for the Baseball Hall of Fame. Maybe just because of longevity, because they were healthy enough to play for 19 years. They were never their best player, but he was there that long, so we're going to put him in. I don't know. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about Halls of Fame. I probably should, because I'm going to be on the voting panel for the World Golf Hall of Fame in 2 years. But, you know, I don't know. I think it's a great thing if you get put in. And, you know, I understand sometimes same way I look at people, I'm like, really? They put that person in, but they don't have that one in? I don't know. You'd like – the LPGA did its best to make it purely based on achievement, took all the subjectivity out of it. But I think there has to be some subjectivity.
Yeah, you brought up Weisskopf, and another name that I saw bandied about, and I didn't know a whole lot about him. He was one of my dad's favorite golfers, and I did some research, and that's Champagne Tony Lima, who died in a plane crash, but had a run of between 62 and 66 where he won 12 times and a major championship, and, you know, he died at the peak of his powers. And, you know, I wonder, okay, how do we judge his career, you know, based on the players of today, and do we somehow let in on potential of what might have been, similar to the way that you can argue that Fred Couples got in on potential of what might have been had his back not gotten hurt?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's some veterans. I know baseball does veterans things where they let guys in who hadn't made it previously. You know, I think Tony Lima's a great one. I'm old enough to remember him being a big star in golf, and I think the champagne thing sort of took off and it sort of separated him, and he was, you know, a colorful player from what I recall and all that. I think that's what you have to weigh all the time back and forth. I mean, here we are, I mean, have 40, 50 years, and we still talk about Tony Lima, and his name comes up from time to time in discussions, and there's a lot of players who did a lot of things who you don't remember at all like that. So you know, I think that sort of speaks to it. I mean, as I've always talked about, I mean, there hadn't been many more players in golf than John Daly. Now, he's never going to get in the Hall of Fame, but he was won two major championships. And when you're painting the mural of golf over the last 25 years, you can't paint it without John Daly in the middle of it.
Very true. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. Our guest taking Dead Aim. You mentioned the Ryder Cup briefly a few minutes ago. This week, Lee Westwood pulls his name out of the hat. Luke Donald pulls his name out of the hat. Padraig Harrington appears to be the last slip of paper in the European Ryder Cup Captain Selection Derby. Were you surprised by Westwood saying he feels like that at age 47 he could make the team in 2 years?
Well, I think he wants to, and what I don't know is how much behind the scenes, sort of like, all right, you know what, we're going to slot it here, 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 and here. I mean, I've been told multiple times by people who know that, you know, the next three American captains are slotted, Stricker, Tiger, and Phil. That's what they're going to do. And so they've already sort of put that in place to make it happen. Maybe the Europeans are doing some of that. I don't know. But, I mean, Patrick Harrington would be, as passionate as you could get in terms of being captain for the Ryder Cup team. And I would think he'd do a great job. Now, his pregame talks, pre-tournament talks could get a little windy because he can't go on and on.
You wrote this week about the retirement of Johnny Miller, and I could be wrong, but before Miller, I think that Trevino did color on NBC along with Vin Scully, and Lee was just Lee. It was fun. It was insightful. At the time that Johnny began with NBC, Venturi was the color guy on CBS, and he was also insightful. Neither was critical at all, really. Miller had no trouble being critical, yet he was criticized for it, but his style is now the pervasive style in the analyst world, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's the most important announcer in golf history, I think. I mean, what he did and the way he took it. He was just Johnny Miller being Johnny Miller. And maybe nobody could speak to the game and what it does to you and how you have to play it better than Johnny Miller, because at his best, nobody's ever hit irons better than Johnny Miller. I mean, it's not even... You know, that's almost inarguable. But then the guy basically couldn't putt, and ultimately got the yips and couldn't play competitive golf because he couldn't putt. So he knew the good and the bad, and he just had a way about him. And, you know, I was talking to Jay Haas and Brandel Chambly this week, both of them, for a column about Miller. And, you know, Jay played with him and then listened to him in the booth and said, you know, the thing he had to understand was – there's not a mean bone in his body. I mean, he was not trying to be vindictive. It was just what he saw, and he would just say what he saw. And Shipley had great line. He said, analogy. He said, you know, until Johnny Miller, announcers gave you golf through a microphone. Johnny Miller gave it to you through a microscope. And he put himself there, and he understood he could watch and see players and had this great – predictive ability about him, because he understood what players were thinking and feeling in large part. And, he had the gift of not being afraid to be wrong and not being afraid to be right. And I good for him. He's going out on his own terms, and congrats to NBC for pulling it off to add the perfect person to follow him in Paul Azinger, because that he was the guy that they needed to get, and they've gotten him. And, I just think, while you lose Johnny Miller, you get a great one in Azinger.
Well, and we're one sick day from Dan Hicks away from having Azinger reunited with Tirico on NBC. And I thought they were great on ESPN back in the day. You and I, neither one, claim to be experts on the business of television. But does it surprise you that Fox and NBC are so chummy sharing a color analyst?
Well, given their background with the U.S. Open and all that and how it went away, they let CBS let Think Fowler work the Golf Channel, which is owned by NBC. So I think, maybe it's something to the gentleman's game. I don't know, but I'm glad it worked out that way.
Do you think in our lifetime we will ever see one of the major broadcast partners of the tour have someone in the number one analyst position that doesn't necessarily have the major championship gravitas, but is instead someone who's very knowledgeable, opinionated, and likable?
I think the guys they got there are set up for a while to go. I mean, I think if you could find somebody, are you suggesting Dennis Miller might be in the booth?
No. I'm just saying.
Or Tony Kornheiser?
No. I'm suggesting that just someone who, perhaps, for instance, somebody who's an entertaining writer on the game of golf, just off the top of my head, someone like an Alan Shipnuck. For example, who can be controversial, but is insightful, knowledgeable of the game, and is opinionated. Do you see a time when they might try something like that?
I mean, they might try something during a weekday thing, but, that's how a Faraday or somebody started. But I think it's become such a big business that I don't see that happening. I think they want to go with guys who have been there and know that. I think you could use somebody as an essayist, the way Jimmy Roberts or somebody does them. I think that's the best way you could use writers. I mean, I know there are plenty of guys in my business who sometimes you thought they were auditioning for television gigs, and some of them wound up doing it. I think you look at what Jaime Diaz does at the Golf Channel. I mean, the best golf writer in the business.
Love Jaime.
And transferring it over to television. It's different. I mean, it's been an adjustment. We've talked about it. He still does some writing, but there's something to be said for the immediacy of television. You do it, and it's there, and it's done. Whereas if you're writing it, it sort of hangs out there all the time, and you're sort of waiting and putting things together. It's different, but the world has changed. There's room for both, but I don't see somebody like that going up to be the 18th tower analyst right now.
See, I thought maybe, just maybe, when Johnny retired, that they might experiment with putting, because I like the chemistry that they have on the Golf Channel with some people, either Duvall and Chambly together or Nobolo and Chambly together, sort of two halves of one person to go along in the booth.
I don't know that Chambly ever really pursued it. I mean, I just talked to him half an hour ago, and he said I could not have been happier when they picked Azen because he thought that's who deserved to have it and everything. I know when I did the Duvall for a couple of years ago, there was talk that maybe he could get that job. I don't know that, I don't know if he worked it hard enough or whatever. I just think Zinger was the right guy.
Get you out of here on this. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. Your gut feeling on this one, fill in the blank. The Tiger-Phil pay-per-view matchup over Thanksgiving weekend will be blank.
Underwhelming.
I think so, too.
I think it's lost a little of its pop. Now, maybe as we get closer and maybe they'll throw a wrinkle or two in, it'll capture our attention and all that, but I don't hear a lot of people talking about it. I don't think the Ryder Cup really helped it. And I think the fact that they're pushing it to pay-per-view probably turns some people off. It just feels a little late in the game.
One of my favorite people in golf, no question, from the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr. And when we return, HBO Real Sports correspondent Armin Katayan takes dead aim at the subject of a controversial biography he's co-written with Jeff Benedict, Tiger Woods. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
We are taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Along with Jeff Benedict, HBO Real Sports correspondent Armin Katayan has written the definitive, in my opinion, biography of Tiger Woods, and we had the chance to speak earlier this summer. Armin, there have been so many books written about Tiger. Some of them are good, some of them are fluff, some of them, like Haney's, are kind of on the verge of being juicy, angry, bitter, tabloid-style stuff. Knowing that all of this was out there, what was the story? What was your story that you wanted to tell? What was the angle you saw, the opportunity?
Well, I think, Charlie, what we saw was, and I say we because Jeff Benedict was, we were partners in this thing, and is that when we really read all those books, and we read them and we annotated them and we looked long and hard at what each of them was trying to say, they all fit into certain sort of slots. They were either told by Earl or they were told by some very accomplished golf writers, but they focused on certain segments of Tiger's life, either the rise up and the turning pro and then probably going into the Masters in 97, or there was another spate of books that came following the scandal in 09, and the books came out in 2010. There had never been a comprehensive, immersive, 360-degree look at Tiger's life by people who consider themselves pretty serious journalists in terms of wanting to write and have written some big-time nonfiction books. So we felt that there was an opportunity there if we did things right and we had the amount of time we felt we needed, that we could produce a full picture of Tiger's life. And to do that, you had to go back deeply into Earl's life and Tita's life, his mother, Cotita. And as it turned out, as Jeff and I were into the 3 years of reporting and writing of the book, we knew we had something special because of what we were getting in the interviews, but also because of the truly sort of Shakespearean arc to Tiger's life.
Oh, he is. He's Hamlet. It's amazing. I imagine from the start, between Steiny and every lawyer in New York and Florida, how many cease and desists and how many roadblocks were thrown up in your face before you felt like you even got the project off the ground? I mean, was there ever a point or were there multiple points where you just wanted to go, screw this, this isn't worth it?
Oh, no. We were actually the opposite. We were like, okay, so now we've got, you know, the lawyers and Glenn Greenspan is chief spokesperson. But you even have to go back into include Tiger in that category because Tiger, as you well know, is an extraordinarily private person and has put up some pretty professional roadblocks in terms of non-disclosure agreements with people that he's either had relationships with or business relationships with. People like Hughes Norton, his first agent, has a very detailed non-disclosure agreement. There are other people that were employees of the Tiger Woods Corporation that part and parcel of their job is to sign a non-disclosure agreement. Tiger went so far as to literally call up his high school district and the superintendent's office and request that his yearbook, high school yearbook, not be shown to anybody, let alone the media. And as I found that out in talking to a librarian, an assistant librarian at Western High School, I was, you know, kind of drawn to remind her that, you know, this is a public high school paid by taxpayer funds, and it's a public library at a high school. So you're telling me that we can't look at his yearbook? And she said, yes, I'm sorry, that is what I'm telling you. And then there was this wonderful pregnant pause where she said, but if I was you, I might go over to the local library for the city of Anaheim because I'm pretty sure they have all the high school yearbooks in that, and they're not under the same obligation that we are. And sure enough, those high school yearbooks were there. But purely from Tiger's side of things, the inner circle, when Jeff and I initially reached out to Tiger's people in January of 2016, more than 2 years before the book would be published, all we asked for was the opportunity to sit down with either Tiger or Mark Steinberg or Glenn Greenspan to discuss what we were going to attempt to do in the book. And in response, we got a pretty nasty email in return that said before they would even, quote unquote, consider speaking to us, we had to tell them everybody that we had talked to, everything that those people had said to us, and we had to provide a list of questions to Tiger in advance of any interview. And those were just conditions that Jeff and I and no serious journalist would ever consent to.
Well, that's a lot fancier than I heard. I heard that Tiger just faxed you a picture of his middle finger. And Armagedain is the co-author of Tiger Woods, along with Jeff Benedict. Thank you for bringing up the non-disclosure agreements. I don't mean this to sound flip, but I'm actually kind of serious. If you were to estimate, how many non-disclosure agreements do you think that Tiger Woods has out there?
I would say there are dozens. I know several of the, you know, his former paramours that we contacted, including some names that have only briefly surfaced, just refused to speak because they had signed, they had been paid X amount of dollars, but, you know, in conjunction with that payment was a signature of a non-disclosure agreement. I do know that every employee that virtually every employee that had worked for either the corporation or for Earl Woods, some of those women being paid by the corporation, had to sign non-disclosure agreements. I know that obviously Elon has a very complicated and lengthy non-disclosure agreement. But we were able to speak to people very close to her in order to fill out certain sections of the book. And look, I mean, in Tiger's defense, as many mega celebrities will do, if you're a Hollywood A-list actor and you have a maid, or you have an estate manager or a major domo or somebody that's your executive assistant, they all ask for those things and require many times that people sign non-disclosures. So it was one of the hurdles that we definitely had to deal with, but it's the reason, you know, Charlie, that we wanted 3 years to do the book, because we knew from experience in these kinds of matters that oftentimes it takes multiple conversations and multiple attempts before someone will even agree to speak with you on the phone or allow you to come to their house to explain the purpose of the book. And it did take us, in several cases, multiple attempts to build confidence and trust before people have finally agreed to tell their story, some of them on the record, some of them on background.
Armagedain is the co-author, along with Jeff Benedict, of Tiger Woods. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. You bring up the women in Tiger's life, and I wasn't as intrigued. I think I've read about everything I wanted to read about, you know, the hundreds of women, the Perkins waitresses. You know, all of that is pretty much out there. But there were some names that you had in the book that I had always found fascinating, and that they just seemed to disappear off the map. I consider them the women of Tiger's innocence, if you will. The first one, his high school sweetheart, Dina, yes, that I had never heard about. But then the one I really wanted to talk about is Joanna. And for people who don't remember, Joanna was the blonde before Elon, who was sitting next to Mom at St. Andrews when Tiger completed the career Grand Slam. And then Armin, it was as if she disappeared off the map. I never heard another thing about her. What is she doing now?
She is now a corporate vice president, assistant general counsel for a very large financial institution. We made several very respectful attempts to contact Joanna, all of them which met with complete silence from Joanna's end. And that sort of is Joanna. Joanna Jagoda, as you mentioned, was Tiger's really second sort of true love after Dina Gravel, which, as you mentioned, is one of the, I think, most emotional and eventually heartbreaking stories of a first true love that ends in the worst of ways when Tiger's parents intervene and basically remove Dina from Tiger's life because she's perceived as an obstacle as he's marching his way toward becoming a pro. Tiger meets Joanna at a party at University of California, Santa Barbara, kind of a blind date sort of thing, at this party where they're kind of, you know, match made together. And Joanna, she doesn't want the limelight. She prefers staying out of the spotlight. And she was great for Tiger in a lot of ways because she was you know, she's gone on to get a law degree and be very successful in her own right, but she wasn't afraid to tell Tiger what she thought and what she thought he should do in certain situations. And you mentioned it. It's interesting, Charlie. You mentioned that, you know, she was essentially, you know, once she was out, she was out. There was no, you know, there very little, if any, continued communication. And that's a theme that you see time and time again in Tiger's life. And that I think traces back to Earl, because Earl was very much that same way. But whether it's Dina Gravel or whether it's Joanna Jagoda or Butch Harmon or Hank Haney or a guy by the name of John Merchant, who was very influential in Tiger's early career as he's turning pro, was a second father to Tiger in a lot of ways, and was the first African-American on the USTA executive committee, and was very instrumental in guiding Tiger as he was about to turn pro. Those people are all gone and never to be seen again.
Oh, yeah. No. There was a better chance, seriously, in my opinion, of finding Hoffa than finding Joanna Jagoda. I mean, literally, she disappeared off the map. It was crazy. Armakatayan is the co-author of Tiger Woods, along with Jeff Benedict. He's our guest, Taking Dead Aim. There's so much to cover that you've covered in this book. You spend a good deal of time, because it's become, I don't know, the biggest story of the last 4 or 5 years with Tiger, on injuries and their toll and the treatment of them. Specifically, you got into the back injuries. And what I wanted to ask you was, I've just had an opinion. Justin Rose has had back problems. Hunter Mahan has had back problems. Tiger Woods, hello. The three of them, the common thread is Sean Foley. How much of Tiger's back issues would you credit to getting involved with Sean Foley?
That's a good question. It's one I haven't really heard yet, which is surprising. So I think it, and then let me just dial it back to Tiger. I do know that Tiger has had conversations with people where he has traced some of his back issues to the Foley method, a method which has since, if you've read that part of the book and remember it, where Brandel Chambly says that Sean has become a better teacher, a different teacher now in the way he teaches the setup and the swing. But when Sean was given the keys to the Tiger Kingdom, and I'll quote Brandel here, paraphrasing, he wasn't quite ready as an instructor for that. And Sean's training method at the time was very different. And it put a lot of pressure on Tiger's back at a time when Tiger's back was not capable of that kind of a swing change. And I think, do I believe personally that it contributed to it? Yes, I do. I think it was a Tiger, there was a certain desperation in Tiger's mind at that time when he was really searching for something that could get him back on top. And Sean, with all his, you know, his kind of fancy talk and submodal, you know, banalities and a few other, and I'm just sort of making up these phrases, but they were the kind of things when Stevie Williams heard them, he barely understood what Sean was talking about. and I think, as I said, Sean has changed his method since then, but you know, Tiger's back was a compendium of his incredible workouts twice a day, 90 minutes at a time, the whole fascination and obsession with the SEALs, you know, and the hours and hours and hours of practice that he loved to put in. And you know, those three things coupled with you know, in golf, form equals function. It's a ground force sport. And it's a little bit like that old rhyme that says, you know, the ankle bone's connected to the knee bone's connected to the thigh bone's connected to the hip bone's connected to the backbone.
Right.
And all of that, and this is something we didn't get into a lot in the book, but I spent a lot of time talking to experts about it, and Tiger's kinetic chain has always been, according to the experts, pretty messed up. And he's taken either swing changes or he's done things that have been focused on the problem, but not on the source. And he's never really gotten kinetically connected. And that exacerbated his back problems in the end. And it was really the end result of things that had started with the torque in his swing and all of the knee injuries, the left knee injuries that he was suffering. That's where all of that energy gets displaced, starts in the foot, and then it works its way up to the knee. And once the knee is considered to be kind of a dumb bone, the ACLs, and that gets transferred up into the neck and the shoulders and the back. And that's when Tiger really began to fall apart. And some of the experts I've talked to who were watching him swing said it was only a matter of time before these, back surgeries, these microdiscectomies were going to occur.
The book, Tiger Woods, co-author Armin Katayan, and up next, he continues to take dead aim at the man many consider to be the best golfer of all time, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We're taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Armin Katayan is the co-author, along with Jeff Benedict, of Tiger Woods, and we continue our conversation now.
Before the back surgeries, something that was often whispered about, but never a formal accusation made, and you sort of dove into it, was the treatment mm-hmm. of Tiger Woods' physical ailments and conditions, and the magic words, performance-enhancing drugs. And
and
reading your book, in my mind, whenever I think PEDs, I think of Barry Bonds, I think of Balco, and I think that all of a sudden, I remember Barry Bonds looking one way, and 2 years later, his head was the size of the tire of my car, and you could trace it back to that. With Tiger, it was a little different to me in that he was such a fanatic about working out in the gym, and it was a gradual thing. He didn't just show up at the golf course one day and look like, Greg Olson with the Carolina Panthers. That took time for him to get that body, and it all sort of made sense. And so I always thought of PEDs as steroids, but as I was reading your book and I was reading, it's really gotten me to think how much of this platelet spinning is actually performance enhancing. How much of it is just recovery? Where do you come down on it now?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, look, if there's a third rail with Tiger's people, it's performance enhancing drugs. And if you're going to make an accusation, and Jeff and I had long discussions about this, if you're going to accuse Tiger Woods of using any kind of performance-enhancing drugs, you better have stone-cold proof. And I mean multiple eyewitness accounts or documentation or something that is unimpeachable, because you're going to get sued. And if you can't defend it, then you better not print it. And what I think we did in that chapter called Miracle Workers is give the reader as the best understanding to date as to not only all the injuries, but what Tiger's treatment was like by Mark Lindsay, who was his go-to chiropractor when Tiger's knee was really post-surgery in 2008, and Tony Gallia, Dr. Anthony Gallia, the Toronto doctor, who was considered a miracle worker with PRP, the platelet therapy. And we say in the book that, and from an account that we believe to be credible, backed with a bunch of other things that came out of documents, that when Dr. Gallia was treating Tiger's left knee, he had this thing called a cocktail of healing, where there were growth factors and other sort of specially constructed injections that Dr. Gallia would put into Tiger's knee or Achilles or other places. Some of those injections contained minuscule, quote-unquote, minuscule amounts of HGH and testosterone. And that was part not of performance enhancement, Dr. Galley would argue, but it was part of the recovery treatment. And because those amounts were so minuscule, they would have been out of the body in a way that would have been undetectable within a day. So when you were getting these very specific injections, was Tiger aware of what was in that injection? It's doubtful that he was. Was Tiger involved with performance-enhancing drugs, meaning testosterone, HGH, of any of those other kind of so-called PEDs? We found no proof of that. And we got so far as where we got the, we end this chapter with a part of this four-page declaration that was provided to us by Dr. Lindsay, where he categorically denies that Tiger used any PEDs. And as Mark said, I've known Mark for the better part of 20 years. He's worked on people that I know. He's actually worked on my body at times. And I don't believe that Mark Lindsay would put his professional reputation on the line to say anything but what he believes to be the truth. And because he had his hands on Tiger so many times, hundreds of times between August of 2008 and October of 2009, and he said, you know, I have these kind of magic hands that I would be able to feel if somebody's using PEDs. And he said, I never felt that with Tiger. So that's where we leave it. And I think that's a very, very fair way to describe what has been, as you suggested, not just whispers, but, you know, outright suspicions, that outspoken suspicions that Tiger was using PEDs at some point in time.
See, I'm suspicious of any doctor that has anything called a cocktail of healing that does not involve Kentucky bourbon. Armin Katayan is the co-author of Tiger Woods, along with Jeff Benedict, our guest taking Dead Aim. A couple of things to wrap things up here. I love the chapter about Tiger and Lindsey Vonn because you bring up something that I have felt my entire life, and I think it's an absolute truth of anyone in any walk of life that becomes uber successful, elite in their field, and that is those people at some point make some very selfish choices, and they choose themselves over anyone else because you have to reach that level. And that's why I had such high hopes for Lindsay and Tiger, because you had two people who had made those choices and who understood those choices. It just, I thought it kind of sad it didn't work out.
Yeah, I thought that was, she was great for him. I do believe that, and you're absolutely right. They were cut from the same bolt of cloth. They were, when you look at Lindsay's history, a very strong-willed father. She was on skis at the age of two, extremely insecure about her body. She's a beautiful woman in my mind, but she's always been very self-conscious about what she looks like physically, because she's so strong-looking. And her and Tiger were so familiar in their insecurities and in their drive and in their passion for their sport. And I think part of it was that they were separate oftentimes, Lindsay in Europe or training, you know, around the world, and Tiger doing his thing. And it was sad. I mean, you know, that's part of the book. There's many times, you know, Charlie, I'm sure you're reading the book and you're thinking the word sad just comes to mind. It's like sad. And their breakup was one that, you know, I think was really tough for both of them. But there's also that moment where Lindsay has that very traumatic training accident and, you know, basically just smashes her forearm and her arm. And you know, that was after they broke up. And you would think that Tiger, just out of common decency, would call her and say, how are you doing? Nope. You know, that's part of that amputation. Yeah. When you're done, you're done.
What kind of father is he, by all accounts?
I think he's a great father. And I think he's the kind of father that is a far cry from many aspects of what Earl was like for him. I don't certainly think that Tiger puts his kids through any sort of psychological warfare training, as Earl did with Tiger, at Tiger's request, by the way. But I think Tiger is experiencing through his children many parts of of a human life that he just never was able to experience because of the expectations and the demands that were put on his shoulders, and that in many ways he willfully and willingly accepted. But I think that's the reason he's back where he is right now, Charlie. I think that incident last Memorial Day weekend, where he was found on the side of the road in Florida, thinking he was in California, a rock star cocktail of drugs in his system, I think that was rock bottom. And I think the crawl out of that hole, a deep cavernous hole and into the light, was in large part because he wanted to be a father that to his children that his parents weren't for him. And I know that sounds a little bit like I should be laying down on a couch when I'm saying it. But, when you spend 3 years of your life with somebody and you live and breathe his life for as long as Jeff and I did, and I think it probably gives me at least a little bit of a right to say that.
The former and current Ms. Elin Nordegren, she of the nine digits before the decimal settlement and mother of his two children, what does she do now?
Well, she's down in Florida. She graduated from Rollins. She was actually the valedictorian at Rollins College. And, anybody that you talk to who knows Elin very well says, her beauty is one thing, almost unsurpassed. And stunning, and just how just beautiful she really is. But she's funny. She's very self-assured. She's got a life, down there that doesn't require her probably checking the ATM account very often because, she was paid a lot of money, but she also went through a pretty public humiliation. Oh. I can't even imagine. And I keep going back, just to that one text that Tiger sent, as he's cowering behind the bathroom door, maybe not cowering, but he's behind the bathroom door and Elin has been through his phone and it's this fateful night when he's going to run into the fire hydrant. And there's this text that Tiger had sent to Rachel Yucatel, who's probably more so at that point in time the love of his life than his own wife. And he sends Rachel a text that says, "You're the only one I've ever loved." I cannot imagine what would go through my wife's mind if she saw that on my phone. And so I think Elin has been a regal presence through this whole thing. She's talked once to People magazine and said what she had to say in the way she wanted to say it. And she's been silent ever since. And, God bless her as far as I'm concerned.
Final question, Armin. Is he happy or is it unfair for us to apply that term to him because our paradigm of happy may be far different than his?
Charlie, I think he is happy. I think he's happier than he's ever been. I think as I mentioned, that incident on Memorial Day weekend changed him. I think physically he's healthy for the first time in 5 years. Which is a miraculous kind of recovery in this redemptive story now that we're all living through. I think he just loves the game of golf. He doesn't have a lot of other, things and people that he wants to spend time around or with. And the fact that he can go out and play, that he can compete, at the U.S. Open, that he can act as sort of the grandfather figure to all these young guns who want a piece of him. This is what makes him happy. But I think the fact that he can do things with his kids now, including just kick a soccer ball or pick them up and hug them, when at times he couldn't even get out of bed, he's a happier guy than I've ever seen him. And I saw him, for 3 years at various places. And when I saw him out at Torrey in January at the Farmers Insurance Open, that was a different Tiger Woods. That was a more human, a more engaged, more appreciative Tiger Woods than I'd ever seen. And I just hope it's not a mirage. I hope it's not some PR thing, but I don't believe it is.
That's HBO Real Sports correspondent Armin Katayan, co-author along with Jeff Benedict of Tiger Woods. I'd also like to thank Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer for his time and insight this week. Hey, reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Also, a great way to stay in the loop, just be a regular consumer of our Facebook page. Like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there right now are articles on Johnny Miller retiring, including a great story by Jim Nantz. Maybe my new favorite trophy on the PGA Tour and a new agreement between the Caddies Union and the PGA Tour. Hey, weather-wise, fall has finally arrived in the QC, so layer up and get your golf on. And if you do tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.